Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Around 11 or 1200, a few centuries before Columbus arrived in the Americas, one of the largest cities on the continent was Cahokia. It had a peak population between 25 and 50,000 people. Cahokia's population consisted of farmers who grew large amounts of corn and craft specialists who made beautiful pots and jewelry and fine clay figurines. But one of the most amazing things about the city were the large earthen mounds. And if you look at these mounds, don't think of a big hill, think of a huge trapezoid that can still be seen today and were encountered by explorers from the New World with complete confusion. They found dozens of these mounds, and the biggest was in Cahokia, and building it was nearly as impressive as building the Great Pyramid of Giza. That's because the mound stood over 100 feet tall and took an estimated 22 million cubic feet of earth. The earth and clay was brought in by baskets, and the entire structure may have been built as quickly as 2 years, based on soil samples and plant remains in the strata. We don't know how it was built. It's almost as mysterious as how the Great Pyramids of Giza were built, so it probably took a very organized society and a very charismatic leader to be able to pull it off. So to build something like this and to maintain a population this large required a strong central government, and the leader who ran it may have been considered a deity. And we don't know this because there aren't written records left behind, so we have to rely on archaeology. But the most interesting thing about Cahokia, or at least to those who don't know about it, is that this wasn't an Aztec or Incan or Mayan city, one of the civilizations that we think of when we think of the pre-Columbian Americas. This city sat in what is now southern Illinois, across the Mississippi River from modern-day St. Louis. Now, when people think of the North Americas before Columbus, they imagine tribes living in Neolithic conditions that you'd see in Eurasia about 10,000 BC. And any advanced civilization was in Mexico or Central America or South America. But Cahokia, at the height of its population, was bigger than any city in what would become the United States up until the 1780s, when Philadelphia grew beyond 40,000 people. And according to some estimates, the population of 13th century Cahokia was equal to or larger than the population of 13th century London. Cahokia was the crown jewel of the Mississippian culture. This was a mound-building Native American civilization that flourished in the Midwestern, Eastern, and Southeastern United States from 800 to 1600. And it was composed of a number of urban settlements and satellite villages linked together by loose trading networks. In this episode, we're going to be looking at Cahokia and Mississippian culture. I'm answering a question from listener Michael Piccinetti about how the Mississippian culture came into being and what was the extent of their civilization. But more than just looking at the Mississippian culture and Cahokia, I want to discuss why some civilizations develop into what we consider advanced civilizations and others don't. By advanced, I mean a civilization that has long-range trade, literacy, metallurgy going into the Bronze Age and then the Iron Age, astronomy, science, and technology. Now, we see that many Mesoamerican civilizations had these elements. And for a long time, North American Indians were written off as not having these elements. But that's obviously not the case with Cahokia. Its inhabitants were able to build massive structures. It had impressive craftsmanship. The people there knew astronomy. As we'll see later on, the entire city was built along astronomical lines. But for some reason or another, the city was abandoned. And by the time explorers from the New World arrive, nobody lives there, and there's not any sort of emerging civilization that we see in North America, although different tribes were on the cusp of achieving this, which we can go into more detail later. But why didn't Cahokia continue to develop? Why wasn't there a large civilization in North America that matched or even exceeded the Aztecs or the Incans to the south? Could Cahokia have continued to develop and maybe had technological parity with the Europeans when they arrived? Many of the ingredients were there, and perhaps a little bit more mixing would have done it. So before we kick off this episode, I want to mention some arguments in favor of Cahokia and Mississippian culture being on the cusp of becoming an advanced civilization, and also reasons against why Cahokia and Mississippian culture wouldn't have become advanced. For arguments four, by 11 or 1200, there were new strains of corn and beans and squash that were bred that could withstand the cold winters and short summers of North America. This leads to a population explosion and the reason you see larger cities in North America in this time period, like Cahokia. And also, the greater Mississippi Basin has more miles of navigable waterway than anywhere else on Earth. If you're a civilization that exploits this potential for trade, for agriculture, then you can't help but become powerful, and this is why some people call America the inevitable empire, because it has so many geographical advantages compared to other places on Earth. Now, reasons why Cahokia and Mississippian culture weren't going to become advanced, some say that American Indian tribal culture was so fragmented that there was never much more than a loose confederation of peoples. There was really no centralized government. And also, residents of the Western Hemisphere were at an eternal disadvantage compared to those in the Eastern Hemisphere because they lacked large animals that could be domesticated. You didn't have cows or sheep or goats or pigs or horses, livestock that are highly productive, but they also work as pack animals. All you have are llamas and alpacas indigenous to the Western Hemisphere. This is the argument of Jared Diamond in his book Guns, Germs, and Steel, that the reason that Eurasian civilizations rose in a way that civilizations in the Western Hemisphere didn't has to do with geographic advantages, and I'll get into more of that later. Let's first describe what Cahokia was before we get into ideas about its origin and what happened to the people who lived there. Cahokia is one of many large earthen mound complexes that can be found in the Ohio and Mississippi River valleys and across the Southeast. There's no reason not to think that these were built by Native American civilizations, but for a long time, archaeologists in America didn't think they were. In the 19th century, the explanation for where they came from was called the Myth of the Mound Builders. The idea that there was a lost civilization that wasn't related to any American Indian culture that built them because the American Indians were thought as being too primitive to make something like this. The reason they thought that has to do with how impressive Cahokia is. It was built on a north-south axis. There were large boulevards that led to a large plaza in the center of the city, and the most important structure was a holy site that encompasses an area larger than the Great Pyramid of Giza. And there were alternating layers of light and dark soil bands that made the mound look like a spiral that was going up toward the heavens. The highest point of the mound was crowned with the large post. And it was probably struck by lightning frequently that really would make people think that there was communication going back and forth between the earth and the spirit worlds. Cahokia consisted of about 190 mounds, and the different shapes aligned into a planned city grid. It was oriented 5 degrees east of north. According to Tim Pocketot, a professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois, this alignment is no accident. It was tied to the summer solstice sunrise and the southern maximum moonrise. So it oriented Cahokia to the movement of both the sun and the moon. Basically, the entire city was built around astronomy. Neighborhood houses, plazas, causeways, and mounds were aligned to the city grid. If you walked from Cahokia's downtown, you'd encounter neighborhoods of rectangular, semi-subterranean houses with hearth fires, storage pits, and smaller community plazas. According to the archaeological remains, the people who lived there weren't from any one tribe, but people came and went to the city from across the mid-continent. They would have had different customs, different dialects, and different crafts that they brought with them. I already talked about the largest mound, Monk's Mound, and it's called that because of the French Trappist monks who lived there in the early 1800s. In front of Monk's Mound was a large open plaza where people would play the popular sport of chunky. The game was played by two groups who'd run across the plaza, lobbing spears at a rolling stone disc, and thousands of people would watch. The goal was to land the spear at the point where the disc would stop rolling. In addition to the chunk yard, where this game was played, additional platform mounds were built along the plaza edges. Considering how it was made, Cahokia was built very rapidly. Thousands of people came together to help out with its construction. And as far as archaeologists know, there was no forced labor used to build these mounds. People came together for big feasts and gatherings to celebrate the construction of the mounds. I did an episode a long time ago about the pyramid builders, and archaeologists think that too, that yeah, there was some slave labor, but it was a lot of skilled craftsmen who were involved. It wasn't just people lugging giant stones like army ants. Other mounds in Cahokia were built for different purposes. Some for burials, some for defense, some to mark important locations, some for government officials. The mounds were either rectangular platforms, or conical burial mounds, or triangular markers. Professor James Brown says that one of the most impressive things about building the city was that land was leveled for miles around the city center. And this isn't as easy as you think in the Midwest, because we usually think of the Midwest as being completely flat, as if it's Nebraska if you drive through, which is mostly flat. But a lot of the landscape has long undulating hills. And to do that in the modern era would take the leveling of bulldozers in order to have a consistent grade. Well, the land is still flat today, and some think that this land flattening helped define the route of highways that crossed Illinois centuries later. Outside the central complex, archaeologists have also discovered a circular pattern of timber that they've dubbed Woodhenge. They think that the original Woodhenge was used like surveyors to set the axis of the city and to site secondary roads to mark important yearly events. It's used for similar reasons as Stonehenge, to chart astronomy. And certain perimeter posts align with the rising sun at the spring and fall equinoxes and the winter and summer solstices. Brown notes that Cahokia was not a city inhabited by people of all one American Indian culture, but it was like a modern-day Manhattan, where residents were drawn from throughout the region of the Mississippian-controlled area. The Pensacola, the Choctaw, the other different tribes. And people in Cahokia were involved in different professions. Some hunted and brought their game to sell in the city, and they gave it to traders who then trade it. Some farmed and also brought in their wares. And presumably you had a number of priests due to the religious sites there, and a number of astronomers. All right, so that's what Cahokia was, and we'll get back to it more as we get into this episode. But I want to take a step back and ask the question that I brought up earlier of why did Cahokia develop at this time in history? Why didn't it develop thousands of years earlier? And was it on the verge of developing into something larger, like the Eurasian civilizations, and becoming something similar to ancient China? Well, the reason for its development at this time has to do with crops. Crops were domesticated in Mexico and Central America sometime between 5 and 10,000 BC, including corn, beans, and squash, and cotton, tomatoes, avocados, peanuts, and chili peppers. And that's why you have civilizations like the Olmecs that go back thousands of years. But these same crops are difficult to grow in cold weather climates, like the U.S., because of the long and dark winters compared to Central America. All of these crops are tropical in origin and can't be cultivated naturally in areas where there are four seasons, and the growing season is much shorter than it is in Mexico and other places to the south. So as a result of this, these crops had a very hard time making it up to the U.S., and for that reason, most of the cultures that exist in what is today the United States were hunter-gatherer societies. But things change around 1,000, about 4,000 to 9,000 years after these crops are first domesticated in Mexico, due to new strains of corn, bean, and squash crops that could withstand the cold winters and short summers. People had been living in many parts of North America for thousands of years, making a living as gatherers of wild plants and hunters of animal meat, and there was some crop cultivation. About 4,000 years ago, Indians in much of the current United States were able to cultivate sunflowers, squash, and other plants to supplement their wild foods. But finally, around 1000 AD, new strains of corn were developed that could thrive in the United States, and they did extremely well in Cahokia. The soil was easy to till, and the people there didn't have steel plows and oxen that would be needed to penetrate thick sod that would blanket the surrounding prairie, so they were able to make use of it. It was sort of a breadbasket of the Mississippi area, and Cahokia rose as its people were able to hunt less, devote more time to building up the city, and take up farming. And according to all evidence we have of the material remains of the people who lived there, they ate well. Probably one of the best ways that archaeologists know how well people were doing in any given civilization is by looking at their teeth. One of my friends, who is an archaeologist in what is modern-day Iraq, was explaining all the things that you can tell with teeth. For example, on your back teeth, most of us still have the ridges that are there, but people by their 20s or 30s, a few thousand years ago, would have had their ridges almost completely removed because they would have eaten much tougher material. Also, if they're going through starvation, that's going to affect their teeth development. You can tell all sorts of things about their nutrition, what kind of animals they ate. If you know what kind of animals they ate, you have a sense of how developed the civilization is by what sort of animals they can domesticate, whether or not there were famines that happened. I was shocked. I mean, you can tell an awful lot about teeth, and that's how many of these archaeologists are able to tell what's going on here when Cahokia does not have written sources to leave behind to us. One archaeologist, John Kelly, said that Cahokia could have been like a Garden of Eden, in the sense at least of the abundance of crops and food that was available there. Around 1000 AD, Cahokia underwent a population explosion. There was corn, but also amaranth, canary grass, and other starchy seeds. Preserved seeds of these species have been found in excavations in Cahokia. People were able to farm without the wheel or draft animals, but despite not having these implements, corn production soared, and there were surpluses found in communal granaries on the mounds. For the first time in North America, you have the food and the crops that can sustain large settlements and proto-cities. So what would have happened next if this development of a society built on corn and beans and squash had been left alone and there'd been nothing outside that would have affected it from the outside world for maybe 1 or 2,000 years? Or what if the cultivation of these crop strains that were able to survive in the United States had come up north 1 or 2,000 years earlier? What would have happened? Well, there's a lot of reason to think that you would have an advanced civilization at least similar to Mesoamerica, or maybe even more advanced, for reasons I'll get into in a second, where you'd have cities, armies, written languages, empires, tax collection, the whole works, that could have developed in the United States. The reason why I think, at least, the civilization could have been even more developed than anything in Mesoamerica has to do with geography. The U.S. has vast, flat, fertile farmland with enormous navigable river systems and consistent and predictable precipitation that's perfect for domesticated crops. The crops that came up north from Mexico had a more difficult time growing down there. The weather is warmer, yes, but Mexico is more mountainous and it has small rivers, and the Yucatan Peninsula is fairly infertile due to the thin tropical soil there. The lack of decent rivers and the erratic dry wet seasons make agriculture hard. This is part of the reason why Maya civilization collapsed around 900. In contrast, the United States more closely resembles Europe, India, and China, regions that were able to sustain highly advanced civilizations for thousands of years because, for not much more reason than they're flat, they have enormous river systems that made trade much easier, and they have soils and climate that are reliable and predictable. This gave Europe, India, and China a good 5 to 10,000 years head start against North America. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere. This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It's only around 1100 AD that the U.S. finally got the chance to begin to build up a civilization with an agricultural base once domesticated crops could be grown. This possibility only lasted about 300 years because once Europeans arrived in mainland North America, the most cataclysmic thing that ever happened to Indian society occurred in the 1500s, and that was the spread of smallpox, against which the native peoples had no natural resistance, and civilization completely collapsed, where in many places, 90% of the population dies. I did an episode once on how much of a civilization needs to die before you see it collapse, and there's no clear answer, but what you can say is that when, say, 30% of a civilization dies, as in the case of the Black Plague in Europe, that causes massive reform, society is fundamentally altered, and it doesn't go back to what it was before. That's why many people think that the Renaissance occurred in Europe because of this. However, when you have 90% of a civilization die, that leads to total collapse. Rebuilding is something that doesn't happen in a generation. It takes several generations, even centuries. And by that time, American Indians are dealing with colonial Europe, and they're not able to rebuild into anything that could meet them on the footing that they would have had a resistance to smallpox and been able to maintain their civilizations and their populations. So all that to say, with the arrival of Europe, this cut short the complex cultures that were just then developing on the backs of these newly domesticated crops that could withstand the long winters in North America. Now, I want to take one more further segue before we get back to Mississippian culture and the Cahokians, and that has to do with environmental history, specifically looking at how the environment shapes civilization and how it shapes the development of civilizations. I mentioned earlier that the real estate on the Mississippi Basin was prime, and you couldn't help but be able to develop a civilization there. I want to explore this idea a little bit further, because some have called the United States the inevitable empire, that this is some of the best geographic real estate on planet Earth, and anyone who's able to fully exploit it for all it's worth can't help but become a great power. So I want to give a little bit more to this what-if argument, that if Cahokia had developed a larger agricultural base, then it was on the cusp of building up into a massive civilization, arguably much more advanced than anything in Mesoamerica, and that would have led to a very different first encounter between the Old World and the New World. Here's what the Greater Mississippi Basin is. It, along with the Intracoastal Waterway, has more miles of navigable internal waterways than the rest of the world combined. The Midwest of the United States has this waterway and is also the world's largest continuous piece of farmland. Don't believe me? Drive through Iowa, and between towns, it's nothing but farm after farm after farm after farm. The Atlantic coast possesses more major ports than the rest of the Western Hemisphere combined. Two oceans insulate the United States from Asia and Europe. Deserts separate the United States from Mexico to the south, and lakes and forests separate the population centers in Canada from those in the United States. The U.S. has capital, food surpluses, and physical insulation more than any other country in the world by a huge margin. So the United States became powerful to a large extent because of where they live. And there's a whole article series in the Stratford Journal called The Geopolitics of the United States, and part one is called The Inevitable Empire, that charts America's rise in global politics and its eventual domination and credits it to geography. So you can read that if you're interested to dive into this further. But one of the big ideas is that the most distinctive and important feature of North America is the river network in the middle third of the continent. The river network is larger in length and volume than any other river network, but that's not what sets it apart. What does is that few of its tributaries begin at high elevation. So what that means is you can go a very long distance by boat. In the case of the Mississippi, the head of navigation, just north of Minneapolis, is over 2,000 miles inland. And here's why that makes a difference. I did an episode where somebody asked me, why didn't Africa develop economically, the continent of Africa, in the same way as Eurasia did? And I point out that Africa has geographical disadvantages. It doesn't have water ports that make it easy for shipping. There are a lot of waterfalls that make it impossible to travel a long distance by ship, and any places where you can, like the Nile, you do have large civilizations. And of course, this problem isn't isolated to Africa. In Siberia, there are many waterways that are frozen. So getting crops from Siberia in the taiga and going to Russia or China or elsewhere is really impossible because it's so difficult to transport them over long distances. But the Mississippi Basin doesn't have this problem. It's basically setting the game on easy mode. And the big factor is that you have these waterways, but you're able to transport crops because North America's arable lands are overlaid by these waterways. Normally, agricultural areas as large as the Midwest are underutilized because the cost of shipping their output to more densely populated regions cuts into the economics of agriculture. Until the very modern period, it wasn't worth it to ship anything over long distance, except by ship, unless you're talking about a luxury item. Even today, with motorized vehicles and shipping, it's still much cheaper to send things by ship. And going back to the Eurasian steppe example, even in modern times, crops from Russia and Kazakhstan and other places occasionally rot before they can reach market. You have to construct massive artificial transport networks and maintain them in order for the land to reach its full potential. But you don't have to do that in the case of the greater Mississippi Basin. Most of the prime agricultural lands are within 100 to 150 miles of a stretch of navigable river. You still need roads and rail lines for collection, but the river ports that seem to be everywhere allow for the entirety of the Mississippi Basin's farmers to easily and cheaply ship their products to markets in North America and all over the world. So Midwesterners are connected to the global economy very soon in the 19th century after that area is developed and farms spring up everywhere. The reason why navigable rivers are so important is that, by definition, they serve twice the land area of a coastline, because a coastline has one bank, but rivers have two banks. And rivers aren't subject to tidal forces, so it's much easier to construct and maintain supporting infrastructure than you would in an ocean. Also, on an ocean, you have storms that can force the evacuation of oceanic ports. Coastal areas, yes, you do have storms, but the forces of the waves aren't nearly to the level that they would be in an ocean. So when you think about the importance of rivers, even today, if you look at a population map of Egypt, everything seems to exist in a thick line directly following the Nile. There are some things along the Red Sea and the Mediterranean to the north, but it's all based on the Nile, and this allowed a massive civilization to be built up in the Nile Basin millennia before other places, and part of the reason why one of the oldest civilizations in the world is on the Nile. Others are along the Tigris and the Euphrates in Mesopotamia. So if I haven't drilled it enough, my point is rivers matter. So long story short, the core of the North American continent is the greater Mississippi Basin, and whoever could control that core would be certain to dominate the East Coast and Great Lakes, but would also have transport, trade, agriculture, and political unification capacity to be a world power, even without having to interact with the rest of the global system. The only reason it didn't happen earlier in North America is because there weren't the crops to grow on that land. Now, let's get back to Cahokia. We described what it was, but we didn't really describe what it was for. It's not immediately obvious what Cahokia was for, and for that reason, there were theories that we think are incorrect today about what Cahokia was, and I mentioned the theory in the 19th century that a more advanced civilization built it and left. That's not true, but it's taken a long time to get any sort of consensus on what Cahokia was, and archaeologists still don't agree. Cahokia is something that for a long time, archaeologists and anthropologists thought didn't exist or shouldn't exist. And that is a place that was built first on religion, not by agriculture. We're starting to find more places like this around the world. For example, one of the world's oldest temples is Göbekli Tepe in southern Turkey. I've been there. It's incredible. And it wasn't built as a human settlement. It dates back 11,000 years before most people think there was settled civilization, when almost all of human society were hunter-gatherers. And this shocked archaeologists because they assumed that the site of a religious temple would have to have the supporting infrastructure of a city. So you have masons, you have other craftsmen. But in order to have a city, you have to have agriculture. So agriculture is what kicks off every type of large building project. We found out with Göbekli Tepe that wasn't the case. The enclosure may have been built to worship the dog star Sirius. It consists of a series of at least 20 circular enclosures. Only a few have been uncovered because excavations have only been going on since the mid-90s. Each enclosure is surrounded by a ring of huge T-shaped stone pillars. Some are decorated with carvings of fierce animals. Others depict the human form. These are megaliths, and two stand parallel to each other at the center of each ring. So what Göbekli Tepe did was put a dent in the idea of the Neolithic Revolution, the idea that the invention of agriculture caused humans to build settlements and develop civilization and art and religion. So religion seems primordial and goes back before civilization, the Neolithic Revolution. With Göbekli Tepe, there's no evidence of agriculture near the temple hinting that religion came first. And we think the same thing about Cahokia, where the population explodes after 1000 and it became this major city center. And much of the change may have had nothing to do with the economy, but what we call religion. The primary purpose for the city wasn't for commerce, although during Cahokia's prime it did bustle with activity, where women would tend to the fields and homes and make pottery and weave mats and fabrics, and men would hunt and store corn and clear trees for construction. But the city's main purpose was sacred meetings and ceremonies, and it took place on the plazas and in buildings inside the palisade. James Brown, a professor emeritus of archaeology at Northwestern University, said, "There was a belief that what went on Earth also went on in the spirit world and vice versa. So once you went inside these sacred protocols, everything had to be very precise." So we can think of Cahokia as, in many ways, a pilgrimage site where a city grew up around it. Think of Mecca in Saudi Arabia. Yes, there is commerce that takes place, which it did since the time of Muhammad, but the main point is for people to go there on a religious pilgrimage. We've learned about Cahokia's religious ceremonies from excavations that have been happening there since the 1960s, and they've yielded really interesting things, like artistic stone and ceramic figurines. There was also a small copper workshop found near the base of one of the mounds, and inside was a fireplace with coals where copper could be pounded and shaped. Archaeologists have also found a mound containing a mass burial. We don't exactly know what it was used for, but some think that the Mississippians may have conducted ritual human sacrifices, like the Mesoamerican civilizations to the south. That's because the remains indicate it was mostly young women buried in these mass graves. Some were likely strangled if they were indeed killed for this purpose, but others could have died of bloodletting. Four men were found with their heads and hands cut off, and another burial pit had mostly males who'd been clubbed to death. The reason we think that it is due to a ritual ceremony and not due to warfare that these people died, or maybe an execution of enemies, is that researchers haven't found evidence of warfare or invasion from outsiders. So the people of Cahokia themselves might have received this violence and doled it out. Emerson said he excavated other Native American sites that were filled with arrowheads left behind by war. But at Cahokia, there were almost none. So it seems that the danger was from people on top of society, not from people from other tribes or locations attacking them. Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
War has played a key role in the history of the United States, from the nation's founding right down to the present. Wars made the United States independent, kept it together, increased its size, and established it as a global superpower. Hi, I'm James Early, host of the Key Battles of American History podcast. In each episode, I discuss American history through the lens of the most important battles of America's wars. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search Key Battles of American History on your favorite podcasting platform.
This is Organized Crime and Punishment. History and crime like you've never heard it. Join Mustache Chris, Steve, and their crew as they take deep dives into the fascinating stories of the Mafia. Find Organized Crime and Punishment at the website organizedcrimeandpunishment.com and everywhere else you find great podcasts. Make sure you tell your friends about Organized Crime and Punishment so that friends of yours can become friends of ours. Forget about it.
The history of the popes of Rome and Christianity reaches into nearly every aspect of history. In the History of the Papacy podcast, we step over the rope. We dive in to discover more about the people, events, and background that define the influence of the popes of Rome and church, not only on the West, but the world. To start listening now, go to ParthenonPodcast.com or search for History of the Papacy on your favorite podcast platform.
Cahokia was abandoned by the time European explorers encountered it. So the question of what happened to it is still ongoing, but it's been a source of a lot of debate for centuries. When archaeology became a formal discipline in the 19th century, early archaeologists who were working on this question attributed the building of these mounds to just about anybody except American Indians. They thought it could be Hindus, Welshmen, Vikings. Somebody visiting from another continent and building these and then leaving seemed more plausible to them at the time. John Fitch, who built America's first steam-powered boat in 1785, thought that earthworks like these found in Ohio, called the Newark Earthworks, were used for military-style fortifications. This contributed to the idea that before Native American civilization was there, there were highly skilled warriors of unknown origin that populated the North American continent. They were a lost civilization that left behind huge works, some sort of ancient Egypt in the New World, or a Mesopotamian-style civilization. These mounds were thought of the ruins of a distant past, or even natural manifestations of the landscape. The American naturalist William Bartram, who lived in the 1700s and early 1800s, recorded local Native American narratives of the mounds, and they seemed to match these mythical origins of the mounds, according to the legends of the people there. In his early journals, which were published in 1791, he recorded that the Creek and the Cherokee who lived around the mounds attributed their construction to the ancients, many ages prior to their arrival and possessing of this country. Bartram's account of the Creek and Cherokee histories led to the view that these Native Americans were colonizers much in the way that Europeans and later Americans were colonizers of this land. And in the 1830s and 1840s, in the Age of Manifest Destiny, this was a way to serve for the justification of the removal of Native Americans from their ancestral lands. Because if Native Americans themselves were colonizers and had removed people, then why couldn't white Americans do the same thing? Later on in the 19th century, with the discovery of ruins in the New World with Mesoamerican civilizations, an increasing number of researchers believed that New World civilizations could reach achievements in Eurasia. With the discovery of massive stone cities in Central America and Mexico, some thought that New World societies could be compared culturally and technologically to those in Europe. However, what really shifted people's thinking was a book published by Lewis Henry Morgan in 1881 called Houses and House Life of the American Aborigines. Morgan was an anthropologist and social theorist, and he thought that Mesoamerican societies, like the Maya and the Aztec, reached the evolutionary category of what he called middle barbarism, which was the highest stage of cultural and technological evolution that any indigenous group in the Americas achieved. In contrast, he said that the Native Americans in the territories of the new United States were examples of Stone Age cultures or Neolithic pre-agricultural cultures that were static, they didn't progress, and were absolutely incapable of technological or cultural adjustment. This view shaped the archaeological research of the time and lasted for decades. At the same time, there was a kinder view of American Indian civilization, but it was equally condescending. This was the idea of the vanishing Indian, a view in the 18th and 19th centuries that depicted Native Americans as a vanishing race that couldn't adapt to American civilization. This was a sentimental view held by people like Thomas Jefferson, who he himself excavated a Native American burial mound, and he was sad about the disappearance of what he called the noble Indians due to violence and corruption of white civilization and the ultimate inferiority of their civilization. So their customs and beliefs had to be documented for posterity. But to their credit at the time, some of the early Americans viewed Indians as models that the New Republic could use in the creation of its own national identity and legacy. Well, in the last century, archaeological research has changed our understanding of the mound builders. They're not seen as isolated monuments that created by a race that disappeared. Today, some tribes link their own history to the mound builders. The Mississippi Band of the Choctaw view the mounds as places that tie their communities to their ancestral lands. So based on what archaeologists agree on as much as they can, who were the people that made up the Mississippian culture? Now, sadly, there is a lot we don't know. We don't know what language they spoke. We don't really know anything beyond what their material remains they left behind can tell us. We don't have any oral histories from surviving tribes because those weren't passed down. All we can really do is look at the archaeological remains and try to piece it back together. So Mississippian culture, which is the last major prehistoric cultural development in North America, spreads over a huge area of the Southeast and the mid-continent, including the river valleys in the states of Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Arkansas, Missouri, Kentucky, Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio. And there are some extensions in Wisconsin and Minnesota. When you're connected by river networks, you can go a long way. We already talked about all the crops that the civilization was based on, and they made it possible for a number of towns and villages to pop up. Each of these would dominate a satellite of lesser villages, and government was likely in the hands of priest rulers. So these village states were theocratic in nature. There wasn't a unitary government that controlled all of these different areas. It was more like confederacies, and in times of warfare, alliances between these settlements were constantly shifting. The nucleus in a Mississippian town was a central ceremonial plaza. Each settlement had one or more pyramidal or oval earth mounds that would be surmounted by temple or chief's residence grouped around the plaza. This settlement was similar to those found in Central and South Mexico and Guatemala. It didn't diffuse into North America until the advent of Mississippian culture. So there could have been some connection between those civilizations. In fact, there likely was, but we don't know how deep it was. Because of the large infrastructure projects like Monk's Mound in Cahokia, it suggests that there was a dominant religious cult and priest rulers that were at least strong enough to command the services of a large, docile population, along with several artists and craftsmen. So there's a number of things that makes a settlement Mississippian in culture, and what this includes is a construction of one of these earthwork pyramids, agriculture based on maize, shell-tempered pottery. This means that marine shells are used as tempering agents in ceramics, widespread trade networks that went as far west as the Rocky Mountains, as far north as the Great Lakes, as far south as the Gulf of Mexico, and as far east as the Atlantic. There was also the development of the chiefdom or complex chiefdom level of social complexity. There was institutionalized social inequality. There was a centralization of political and religious power in the hands of few, or maybe even one. The beginnings of a settlement hierarchy in which one major center with mounds had influence over a number of lesser communities that may or may not have had a smaller number of mounds. And finally, a common set of rituals. And we mentioned earlier that game, Chunky, which was a ritual game playing. The Mississippians had no stone architecture. They worked with naturally occurring metal deposits, and they would do things like hammer copper for ritual objects and make copper plates and other decorations, but they didn't smelt iron or practice bronze metallurgy. So that's an overview of Mississippian culture. What happened to Cahokia? That's our question we're going to look at now. One of the biggest problems it had, and other large centers like it also had, was keeping a steady supply of food. Another problem was waste disposal for dense populations. You'll constantly have outbreaks of disease if you don't have proper sanitation, and even if you do, it's really not until the 20th century when urban centers are able to effectively get rid of waste and not have terrible outbreaks constantly happen. Cahokia became unhealthy for other reasons, including polluted waterways, and because it was an unhealthy place to live, it had to fight with population decline. Dean Snow, in his book Archaeology of Native North Americas, argues that the town had to rely on social and political attractions to bring in a steady supply of new immigrants. Otherwise, the town's death rate would have been higher than the birth rate and eventually would have been abandoned earlier. Well, despite these efforts, the population of Cahokia began to decline in the 13th century. And eventually the city was abandoned in 1300. The area around it wasn't reoccupied by indigenous tribes until around 1350. There's other theories of why the city was abandoned. In addition to pollution problems, there could have been deforestation, overhunting, and flooding. The city was built on a floodplain, so in that sense, it's not ideal. It is easy to get to, so as a site of major religious pilgrimage, it's a great location. But as the easiest place to build a settlement, it's not the best location. Cahokia could have also been invaded by outsiders, but like we said earlier, there's not a lot of archaeological evidence of warfare. There's the defensive wood stockade and watchtowers that enclose Cahokia's main ceremonial precinct, but there's no other evidence of warfare. So the palisade may have been used for ritual instead of military purposes, and it makes sense to have a ritual building in a religious pilgrimage site. Disease in the urban population could have also caused a decline. There could have been a plague outbreak or any other type of outbreak that could have caused it to be hit so hard that it couldn't recover. Or it's likely a number of these factors put together. In 2015, researchers found evidence of major floods at Cahokia. It was severe enough to flood dwelling places, so people could have left, could have caused an outbreak, and causing a downward spiral. The first European explorer to come across Cahokia was the Spanish explorer Hernando de Soto, and he reached it in 1540. By then, the city had been vacant for centuries. French explorers Jacques Marquette and Louis Joliet missed the mounds in 1673 in their expedition, and they didn't report finding any Indians in the area. French monks found Cahokia's mounds in the mid-1700s and later named the largest one after themselves. The nearby Illini Indians in the region told Europeans that they didn't know who had built the mounds. In fact, the name Cahokia is a misnomer because the people there didn't call themselves that. We don't know what they called themselves. We don't know what language they spoke or what songs they sang. The name Cahokia comes from the name of a subtribe of the Illini that didn't reach the area until the 1600s and came from the east. Perhaps the downfall could have been caused from social reasons instead of environmental reasons. There was growing class stratification in Cahokia. The rulers lived in mounds and wooden houses and looked down on others, literally. William Esseminger, an archaeologist, compared the Cahokians to Mesoamerican civilizations in the south in that their social systems became entrenched. Power and position were arguably passed by birthright, and you had a caste system that was similar to arrangements seen in other Native American groups along the Mississippi. Indians in Mexico had a similar social system, but we don't know what direct connections were found between them and the Mississippians. Another reason for their collapse could be environmental mismanagement. As the population of Cahokia grew, the ratio of people to arable land also rose. The area was prone to flooding, and it only got worse due to all the tree cutting along nearby bluffs, causing soil erosion, making the cropland too marshy for corn. So you had to bring in crops from further afield and increase trade. Plus, at this time in the 13th century, there was the Little Ice Age, where globally there was a cooling period, which could have hurt the growing season. With deforestation, it took longer walks for firewood. Cahokians used oak and hickory in the early years, but then later switched it up to energy-poorer, softer woods, a sign of problems. You'd have to cut down a lot of wood to heat buildings, but also build those palisades. So with all that tree cutting, it could destroy wildlife habitats. But that might have been done to overhunting, because how many deer could survive if you're close to a town of 15,000 people armed with bows and arrows who can easily pick off deer from far away? There's not evidence of a sanitary system, definitely not a sewer in Cahokia, so dysentery and tuberculosis could have reached epidemic proportions. Or another theory is, maybe the people there didn't die off. Maybe they were simply tired of city life. It's not as if people would be urbanized and, I don't know, for lack of a better term, city slickers in the way we think of today, where they're not able to handle nomadic life, but many might have just decided to up and leave and return to a hunter-gatherer type of lifestyle. Archaeological excavations of Neolithic settlements find that the people who live in towns and subsist on agriculture frequently traded with hunter-gatherers, and there's no reason these populations would have switched what they were doing. Some hunter-gatherers may have decided to settle, some who worked on farms may have decided to leave it and go hunting, and that could change from century to century based on whether conditions were better for agriculture and growing, maybe during warmer periods, or if it were better to hunt animals of prey in colder periods. Things do change in the Americas in the 1200s and 1300s when buffalo arrive from the west and reach areas just across the Mississippi. And you have some tribes, like the Plains Indians, that subsist almost completely on buffalo. So the choice may have been to compete with thousands of neighbors for firewood and eat corn and fish, or to follow a different style and go after the migratory buffalo and eat red meat. All these different explanations for the downfall of Cahokia, whatever they were, whether it was one or whether it was many of them together in whatever combination, grew strong enough that people moved away over time. The society devolved, if you want to use that word, and returned to small village life. It became archaeologically invisible, meaning that there weren't enough remains left behind to tell exactly what was happening. And that means that there are still new theories coming out. Recently, there was an article published in the journal American Antiquity, and the findings make the case that there was a fresh wave of Native Americans that repopulated the region in the 1500s and kept a steady presence there through the 1700s, even though migrations and warfare, disease, and environmental change led to a reduction in the local population. So getting back to the question at the beginning of this episode, could Mississippian culture have become an advanced civilization in time? We don't know. I would say that, yes, it probably could have. It could have resembled something like the Mesoamerican civilization due to all the geographical factors of the Mississippi Basin, the development of agriculture that comes along. And with buffalo coming in, if there were a larger presence in the Midwest, they had they been domesticated, that could have been a huge source of meat for the people there. Cahokia was abandoned due to a number of factors, but it very well could have been resettled, or maybe another settlement that's not in the floodplain, allowing for an easier long-term presence of people. And with enough time, other settlements could have been developed, and you could have seen an Aztec or Incan-style civilization up to the north. Now, getting to the question of whether it could have developed into something even more advanced, like Eurasian culture, that's a little bit harder. Like I mentioned earlier in the episode, you don't have the same domesticated animals in the New World like you do in the Old World. You don't have the same natural defenses against diseases. So unless civilization got so advanced in the New World that people were able to develop vaccines, or maybe there had been a smaller introduction of Europeans who would come and decimate the population due to the spread of disease, due to their exposure to them, and then the population would rebuild in the New World and people would have these immunities in their system and build up enough so there'd be more presence of a civilization in time when Europeans come, then that could have been the case. But it's hard to say. It just seems that there are certain environmental factors that make it harder for the New World compared to the Old World. Anyway, that's an overview of Cahokia civilization. So I hope that gives some context to what was happening in the New World at this time. All right, so that is all for the episode today. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, Salvador Sanchez, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, you get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a three-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.